Hello and welcome to The Laydown, a podcast where three booksellers from Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, New Hampshire chat about all things literary. My name is Ryan.
I'm Hillary.
And I'm Kelso.
So this is our spooky episode of The Laydown. Halloween is nearly upon us, and I, for one, am so excited. Today we're going to talk about some of our favorite scary, spooky Halloween books, but first let's start with what we've been reading recently. So I just finished up today Hollow Kingdom by Kira Jane Buxton, which, Kelso, I know that's your staff pick.
Yes, it is.
It's a lot of fun. It's a new book, and it is the zombie apocalypse told through the eyes of a foul-mouthed domesticated crow. And it's pretty funny. It's pretty good. I liked it. It had some actually spooky parts, I thought.
I mean, the first chapter of it is ST, who is the crow's name, short for We Can't Say That on primetime TV. His owner, his eyeball pops out of his head, and yeah. ST tries really hard to, put it back in his head, and he doesn't necessarily know what happens, because the animals don't understand a zombie apocalypse like we know as humans, so it's just really fun and kind of funny to hear it being told in all of the animals' perspectives.
Yeah. And, ST definitely has a human perspective on things because he definitely, self-identifies as part human. He is obsessed with humans. He thinks they are the greatest creatures on the planet. He wants to be a human. He hates crows, which is very, very funny. But, of course, as the humans are turning into zombies, he has to kind of learn to coexist with the other animals, and he teams up with his fellow pet, Dennis, the bloodhound, and they go on an adventure to save the domesticated animals from the homes that they've been locked into because their owners are zombies and they can't get out. So they go on this crazy adventure through Seattle trying to save domesticated animals and learning to coexist with the other animals and fight off the zombies in the process. It's a lot of fun.
It's a great read for Halloween time because it's got zombies. It's spooky, but it's not necessarily scary. It's a funny book. It's a funnier book, and I like to recommend things that are not terrifying. Yes. Not everybody likes terrifying literature, that's why it was my staff pick for October.
So that is 20% off. Because it is Kelso's staff pick, and I am co-signing that staff pick. I liked it a lot. So that's kind of the main thing I've been reading. Hillary, what have you been up to?
Well, I've been reading nonfiction, but I think it kind of qualifies as horror fiction. The first one, I can't actually say the title, because it has a swear in it, so I'm going to shorten it. It's called Mind F. Asterisk CK. I think everybody knows what that stands for. Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. It is written by Christopher Wiley, who people might remember as the pink-haired guy who came in and told the story of how Cambridge Analytica teamed up with Facebook to steal the personal information of millions and millions of people.
Yep.
And to try to rig the election by targeting false advertising at susceptible people. But it's a lot more than that. It's a truly shocking story about how these for-profit businesses are being hired by sort of the secret services of various countries and are being used to manipulate other countries in ways that it's not really legal for example, the CIA or MI6 to do. So, for example, interfering in Nigerian elections or Kenyan elections in Trinidad. And it is about the development of ways of gathering information about people that was supposed to be private to the point where they could completely understand exactly who you were, what your address was, what your phone number was, and target you. And then Christopher Wiley began to feel guilt-ridden about this and became a whistleblower. And was attacked by Facebook and by others. And it's pretty terrifying. I highly recommend reading it, especially in light of what's coming up in the elections. Mm-hmm. It talks a lot about Russian interference and how these companies collaborated with Russia to get into our election. So really great book, highly recommended. Mind, F. Blank, C.K., Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America by Christopher Wiley.
Mind bleep!
Yeah. The other one I'm going to recommend is Catch and Kill, the new book by Ronan Farrow. Mm. The subtitle is Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators. And this is another one where you realize how wealthy people are able to manipulate the media and politicians in order to protect themselves. And Ronan Farrow, who people may know, is actually the son of Woody Allen and Mia Farrow. So he has some experience with a sister who accused his father of sexual assault when she was mm-hmm. 7 years old. Mm-hmm. He saw firsthand how a wealthy, powerful man could kind of ruin the lives of his own daughter
yeah.
and his ex-wife
yeah.
in order to preserve his own reputation. In this case, Ronan Farrow is investigating Harvey Weinstein, and it's another case that's just truly shocking, where Weinstein is able to harness NBC executives, private investigators who used to be members of Assad in Israeli Secret Service, to lie to and manipulate women who had been attacked by Harvey Weinstein, about attorneys like Lisa Bloom, who on the down low were working for Weinstein while pretending that they were women's advocates. Mm. It's a really disturbing and fascinating book. I think another one that people should read. So those yeah. were my two books.
Mm. Kelsey, what about you?
Oh, I'm always reading a bazillion and a half things, so I'll try to skim it down to two. The first one I'm currently in the middle of reading, picking up and down, is Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn, The Final Empire. It is a heist kind of, it's high fantasy, so there's a bunch of like mysticism and magic and thieves and things like that. Mm. But it's essentially a heist trope where these band of thieves have to take down the ruler of this empire. And the way they do that is they are susceptible to allomancy, which means they like eat certain metals and gain powers and can manipulate people's thoughts and feelings on situations. And there's a lot more that goes into
it. They're eating metal.
Yes, they consume like zinc and iron to gain these superpowers.
That's so awesome.
There is a main character in the story who's a thief who's getting abused by like the gang of thieves that she has come home to, and then they realize that she has this power of the mist, and she is going to be taking care of this band of like international thieves who are going to like take over this entire empire and try to take it down. And it's really fun. It's a fun high fantasy. You can't go wrong. If you
That's
know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's, you know, in the realm of like Patrick Rothfuss kind of fantasies. It's contemporary fantasy. And I'm enjoying the ride. It's a fun read. The second book I'm reading, which is not out until March, so I will repeat this when it comes out, but I wanted something kind of spooky still. And it's called We Ride Upon Sticks.
Oh, I saw this. This looks great.
And it is wicked enjoyable.
Oh,
Tell them what kind of sticks.
So, picture this. It's 1989, Danvers, Massachusetts, home to the Salem Witch Trials. Varsity field hockey team. They're trying to get and win the playoffs. So what they do is they decide to make a pact to try to win state finals championships. And what they do is they conjure some magic and write their names in the devil's book. The devil's book is actually a spiral-bound notebook with a picture of Emilio Estevez on it. Big hair, witches, crazy things happen. They continue to win. Every chapter is each game that they win to get to the finals. And the later in the story, more strange things happen, and other people around the town want to know what's going on. They accuse them of being witches. And of course, the play that they're doing in the Danvers, Massachusetts high school is the Crucible.
So can they really ride their field hockey sticks?
You know, you're going to have to wait until March to find out.
Maybe I'll read it.
It's so amazing. Fun. It's campy.
like, it's like Heathers. It's you're invoking all of these like big haired girl power. It's a really good refreshing. They're campy about their feminism, but it's also kind of woke as well. It's very refreshing. It's so good for the Halloween season, and I'm really bummed that it's coming out in March.
The next Halloween.
Right. Yes. So in our March episode, I will revisit this because it's going to be my staff pick. Because if there's anything that 15-year-old me opened up to, it was field hockey and witchcraft. And I was like, what?
This is written for you. Yeah, I think I grabbed a copy of this when I was at the NEBA conference earlier this month, because I definitely walked up to a table and I was like, what's good? What do you got for me? And the rep there pitched this book to me, and I was like, I am so sold. This is amazing. But I haven't read it yet.
This is going to be awesome, and I can't wait for it to be March so I can share it with everybody. So yeah, that's what I'm reading.
Awesome.
My 15-year-old heart is like super, super happy.
Okay, so we're going to get into our favorite Halloween reads, but first let's hear from Christopher McDougall, the author of Natural Born Heroes, Born to Run, and his latest, Running with Sherman. I had the pleasure of setting up an interview with Chris for this episode, and in a crazy turn of events, he called me the morning of our interview to let me know that due to a huge storm, he had absolutely no internet. But instead of canceling the interview or pushing it back to a later episode, Chris was kind enough to record his answers to my interview questions, which I had sent him earlier, so that I could kind of Frankenstein our conversation together, which seemed oddly appropriate for our Halloween episode. So please enjoy that interview now. Christopher, you are the best-selling author of Born to Run, which I highly recommend for both runners and non-runners alike. It's a fascinating book, even if, or I guess especially if, the idea of running makes you break out in hives. But today we're going to talk about your new book, which I'm mildly obsessed with, called Running with Sherman. For those of our listeners who haven't had the pleasure of reading it yet, Running with Sherman isn't just a story of a donkey. It's also a story of Amish living, of running, of mental illness, friendship, and so much more. Sherman has his hooves in all areas of your life. What's one of your favorite stories about Sherman?
My favorite story about Sherman is actually the first sign that he was starting to recover. We'd had him for several months. He arrived here really sick, lame, almost impossible of moving. And then one day we noticed that he and a bunch of the other animals were out in the middle of the road. We herded them all back in, closed the gate, forgot about it. 2 hours later, they're all free again, walking up the road, going who knows where. Put them back in, and this time I started to pay attention. And that's when I noticed that Sherman, unique among all of our animals, had figured out how to grab the chain on the gate with his teeth and then shake his head up and down until he threw the chain off the gate, banged it open with his head, and was leading all of the sheep and goats and other donkeys on a slow chase escape.
That is amazing, and honestly, I would expect nothing less of Sherman. Now, what's your favorite part about living in Amish country?
There are a lot of things I love about living out here in Pennsylvania Amish country, but I think the most special aspect is that there's this real community of sharing out here. When anybody has extra strawberries or asparagus or zucchini, the tradition is you just bring it to your neighbors. So early in the summer, I'll hear a bang on my door and one of the neighbor kids will be there with a whole bushel full of fresh asparagus. And then later in the summer, when it's strawberry season, knocking on the door early in the morning, big basket of free strawberries. One time I was running by a farm and a farm dog ran out and nipped me on the leg. It didn't really matter very much. I continued the run. And by the time I got home, there was a plate of freshly baked chocolate chip cookies waiting on the bench by our back door as a thank you and apology for not getting upset about the dog biting me. So that's what I really like. This is a community where people still meet and talk face-to-face. They're not communicating with their thumbs. They're not entertaining themselves with screens. They're super sociable and friendly and funny. I mean, I'm not sure we're going to see an Amish stand-up comic anytime soon, but they have a really good sense of humor and they love a good story. And that, to me, just speaks to my soul.
That sounds amazing. Let's talk about animal names. Bamboozle, Skedaddle, Chili Dog, Awesome Blossom, and of course, Dear Sweet Sherman. Can you share with us some of the other animal names you and your family have chosen and the reasoning behind those names, if there is any?
Yeah, animal names. That's something we've really enjoyed here. So who do we have? We have a goat named Awesome Blossom and another goat named Chili Dog, both named after favorite items on an Applebee's menu. We have Abe and Anna. Both of them actually are girls, named after the two local Mennonite kids who take care of our animals when we're away. We have Sherman, of course, named by my then 10-year-old daughter Sophie because we'd just seen the film Saving Mr. Banks, and she really liked how happy the Sherman brothers, the songwriting Sherman brothers, made everybody feel. We have Flower and Matilda, cool names, but not by us. Now, there is a name that has been a bone of contention in the family. We have a black cat with seriously sinister eyes. I call her Evil Eye. To me, there's no other name. But the girls insist that her name should be Elsie. Now, two goats that really taught us a lesson about being careful with names were Bamboozle and Skedaddle, both of them named by my daughter Maya, and both of whom, and I think it's not a coincidence, became the two greatest escape artists in our entire pen. So from that point on, we never gave a name that could result in some kind of weird karmic luck that would affect the animal's behavior.
I gotta know, Chris, how many animals do you currently have?
So right now, including birds, we have, I don't know, maybe 30 animals, 25. We have about 6 geese, about 6 or so ducks, about a dozen chickens, 4 cats, 6 sheep, 5 goats, 3 donkeys, and I think that might be it.
That is so many animals, Chris. Okay, as this is our Halloween-themed episode of the podcast, I have to know, what is the scariest book you've ever read?
The scariest book I've ever read was actually a series of books I used to read when I was a kid. There was an Ellery Queen mystery series, and ostensibly these were mysteries, but a lot of them were these like weird horror suspense stories. And I was reading these things under the covers with the flashlight, classic scenario as a kid. I was supposed to be asleep, but, you know, preferred to read instead. And those things, to this day, I will not read Ellery Queen mystery series After Dark. A little too bone-chilling and scary for my taste anymore.
Oh, man. Well, now I feel like I have to go read those. Do you have any spooky stories to share, either involving Sherman or otherwise?
I don't know if Sherman does this on purpose, but he has this habit at night. Well, okay, listen, I'll take the blame for this. It might be actually our fault. We realized that Sherman was super sociable, and he didn't like to be separated from us and from the other animals. So we reconfigured our fencing so that our entire house is now surrounded by fencing, so the animals can come right up to the windows, right up to the doors. Which means, of course, that at night, when you're trying to go to sleep, you'll hear this eerie thumping against the house, and then a snorting, and you'll look up and see those two weird donkey eyes staring in the bedroom window. So I don't know. I meant to change the fence. This is not going over too well with the rest of the family.
That's terrifying. That is terrifying. Thank you, Sherman. Chris, thank you so much for chatting with me today. Running with Sherman and Chris's other books are on our shelves now at Gibson's Bookstore.
Huge thanks again to Christopher McDougall, who is so gracious and kind and willing to work with me to make that interview happen. Running with Sherman is on our shelves now. It's a perfect book for animal lovers, runners, and people who enjoy heartwarming stories. Seriously, it's so good. Okay, let's get spooky.
Yeah.
All right. So, I love Halloween so much. I love spooky books. So people who know me know that I don't get scared by anything because for the last several years, I've done the 31 Nights of Halloween where I watch a different horror movie every night and I'm completely desensitized to anything scary ever. So don't ever ask me if anything is scary because my answer will be, I don't know. So that being said, there is one book, one, that has actually kept me up. I couldn't sleep. I was checking the corners of my house. I was looking into the shadows. I had chills all night. And that is, of course, The Exorcist
by William Peter Blatty. Oh, this book. I don't know if it's just because I read it in one sitting, because I did. I picked this up in a bookstore several years ago, started reading it. My husband simultaneously picked up Tina Fey's biography.
Bossy Pants.
And
kind of the opposite.
The complete opposite, right? Which is the epitome of the two of us. And I sat down and started reading it because, you know, I've seen The Exorcist, but I had never read it. And I was like, oh, you know, the movie's, like, I guess kind of scary. Again, I'm so desensitized. It doesn't affect me at all. But I was like, oh, I'm curious about the book because the book is always better. So I start flipping through it. He starts flipping through Bossy Pants, and I am immediately sucked in because this book has such a brilliant building dread because you as the reader know more than the characters, mm-hmm. and you can see things that the characters can't see because you're seeing it written on the page, but they're just hearing it. So, like, when Regan starts to speak in tongues, which is what they think is happening, and mm-hmm. you see that she is speaking backwards because you can read it, and it's just, there are these just, oh, these just building moments. It just builds and builds and builds and builds and builds. And so I'm sitting there super tense reading this, and my husband is next to me, like, slapping my arm, like, hey, I gotta tell you this Tina Fey story. This is hilarious. You're gonna love this. And I'm like, uh-huh, that's great. Okay, sure. So, I don't know. It may have been the entire circumstance of when and how I read this book, but it is the only book that I have ever read, and I was like, that was terrifying. Mm-hmm. And I have this particular edition of it that has this really scary red face that's, like, sort of out of focus. It's like the camera is shaking.
Don't point that at me.
I know, right? So I have this edition, and I keep hiding it in my house because it's creepy. It's a creepy-looking book, and it keeps popping back up on my shelves. Like, I will hide this book in the bottom of a box in the basement, and then, like, 6 months later, I'm looking for something else, and it's on a shelf, shelved incorrectly. It's not in order. It's not on the right.
Nope.
And I'm just like, okay, no. All right. Hey, Exorcist. How's it going? So, I don't know. Yep.
Oh, my
God. That's...
I so hope it's your husband.
It might be.
And not like demons in your bookshelves.
I'm going to have to exorcise your book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I feel like it's like a Ouija board. It's like you can't throw it away or burn it. You have to bury it.
We got some Ouija boards into the store.
And we do. We sell them.
But we had them up by the front register. Mm-hmm. And one of my coworkers, Sandy, and I were standing there, and we looked at it, and we both looked at each other, and we said, that's moving.
No, thank you.
I picked it up, and I put it far away.
Yep. I mean, you know, don't invite the bad vibes.
Everybody has a Ouija board story.
Yeah, yeah.
Of something
I
really
grew up
scary.
With a Ouija board, and I have no idea where it came from. Like, I don't know. It just was always in my house, and I don't know. I still have it. It's one of my Halloween decorations now. It's on my mantle.
I'm not touching one.
But to sort of take a different route, to go the opposite of the scariest book I've ever read, I wanted to talk about a couple of fun, like, cute Halloween books. So I have a 2-year-old, and she loves Halloween as much as I do, which I'm very happy about. This 2-year-old can correctly point to Jason Voorhees and go, that's Jason. And she can point to Pennywise and go, that's Pennywise. And I am proud of that, let me tell you. And two of our favorite books right now, one is Room on the Broom by Julia Donaldson, illustrated by Axel Scheffler. Julia Donaldson has such a great rhythm to her books. Her cadence is perfect. Her rhyme schemes are incredible. And this is a book about a witch who just keeps sort of adopting animals onto her broom as she goes. It starts with just her and a cat, and then her hat blows off, and while they're looking for it, a dog comes out, and he's got the hat, and he's like, hey, can I hang out on your broom? And she's like, sure! And the cat's like, ugh. And this happens over and over. She keeps losing things. Other animals are finding them, and they are joining her on her broom, and then a dragon shows up, and the broom breaks, and the dragon is chasing her, and all of the animals band together to ward off the dragon, and she asks them each to grab something that is meaningful to them, and she throws it in her little magic cauldron, and she creates a brand new broom that has room for all of the animals. Aww. On her broom. It is Aww. Very cute. It's so much fun to read. It's one of those very sing-songy books, but like, I don't know, it's really, really good. So we read that one by request a lot. And the other one that I am recently obsessed with is a new book called The Teeny Tiny Ghost Ooh. By Rachel Matson. And it's just adorable. And it's just about a teeny tiny ghost who lives in a teeny tiny barn of a teeny tiny house. And they're just trying to be scary, but they're teeny tiny, so they let out this teeny tiny little boo. But their teeny tiny boo scares a teeny tiny mouse. And the ghost and the mouse end up becoming very good friends. Aww. And they play, the teeny tinies play in the teeny tiny house, just a teeny tiny ghost and her best friend mouse. Aww. And it's just cute. It's got really cute illustrations. So those are, again, on heavy rotation in my house right now. And then one of my other favorites from growing up is, of course, Bunnicula. Bunnicula, which just came out with its 40th anniversary edition.
I cannot believe that.
Right? I read Bunnicula in, I think, middle school. Mm-hmm. It is about a vampire bunny who drains his carrots. It's a white bunny with red eyes, and suddenly the house is full of just white carrots because Bunnicula drains them all. It's funny. It's a little bit spooky. It was probably one of the first, like, spooky books that I read on my own. And the anniversary edition has, like, a velvet cover. Oh,
it's red velvet.
It's red velvet. Bunnicula is...
And he has little white fangs.
He has little white fangs with, like, a little drop of carrot juice coming out. Yeah, it's so much fun. And it's one of those books that people have either never heard of it, have no idea what you're talking about, or it was one of their favorite books growing up, and they are so excited to talk about it.
I've never heard of that book.
You have to read it. You will love it. I feel like it's almost like a cult classic.
Yeah.
Like, there's a very small population of people who have read it, and those people are, when they hear Bunnicula, are like, oh my god, Bunnicula! I forgot about Bunnicula!
This edition of it is beautiful, too.
It's really gorgeous.
It's also got this new thing of their spray painting, the edges of the pages of books.
Yes, it's got orange edging.
And it has little orange eyes and a little orange carrot juice droplet. Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely bought myself a copy.
Oh, it's fuzzy.
Yeah. It's like, I like velvet. That. The end pages
it's
are
like
really
Pat
beautiful.
It's like Pat the Bunny, only it's Pat the Bunny.
Yeah, so that is a really good Halloween pick for a middle schooler. It's really, really cute. So I have a ton of other picks, but I know some of mine overlap with you guys, so I don't know if we want to, like, open this up a little bit. Hillary, I know you and I are both going to talk at length about Frankenstein.
Yes, Frankenstein, Jeanette Winterson's new book, which is sort of a modern take on Frankenstein, and it is the 200th anniversary of the publication of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Is that not hard to believe?
Wow.
Right. So this is Jeanette Winterson's homage. Mm. And if you don't know who Jeanette Winterson is, she first became famous when she was 25 for a book called Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, mm-hmm. which is a very famous novel about lesbians. And it was one of the first books that was widely acclaimed, you know, that was a book about being gay.
Yeah.
She's written a lot of novels. She's written screenplays. She's written all kinds of things. But this book is... it is like Frankenstein in that it is like sewn together different styles from chapter to chapter.
Yes.
So
that's a really good description.
Part of it is told in the voice of Mary Shelley. She captures Mary Shelley's voice so beautifully.
Yeah.
And it goes from the period of time Mary Shelley's writing Frankenstein when she is 18 years old.
Uh-huh.
And in a rainy castle in Italy with Lord Byron and her husband, or her soon-to-be husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley, who mm-hmm. were both very famous poets of the era. And they and there were some other people there, and they had a competition to see who could write a scary story.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote Frankenstein and then went on to publish it. So we get Mary Shelley throughout the book, from her when she's 18 until the time when she's late middle age.
Yep.
And then you get this contemporary version that is in many ways very satirical. It's not serious in the way the other part of the book is,
mm-hmm.
where we have a contemporary corollary of Mary Shelley called Rye Shelley,
mm-hmm.
who's transgender man.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Victor Stein, who is Rye Shelley's lover, who is a middle-aged expert in AI, and who's looking forward to the day when we all leave our bodies, leave the meat behind, and become creatures of artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Ron, who is the Byron character, who has made a fortune selling sex robots.
Yep.
And there are more corollaries. Well, what I mean is, it's fascinating.
I love this book. I love the juxtaposition of the two stories. So when you're reading the Rye Shelley chapters, you're like, oh, okay, well, this is just, you know, Jeanette Winterson reimagining Frankenstein in modern day. But then they reference Frankenstein. Like, Frankenstein is a work in that universe. So... okay, so then is Rye Shelley a descendant of Mary Shelley? Is, like, it's
mysterious.
It's very mysterious, but the questions that you're left with are really fun. They're not frustrating questions. It's really kind of like, ooh, I feel like I could read this, you know, four times and come up with four different theories for the book. It's a really fun read.
But it's also really profound. I think one of the things that she is addressing in this is the way that literature can actually change society and open imagination in such a way that change happens. So I think part of what she's saying is that Frankenstein, being written in this period where science was just, you know, exploding, forced people to think about the idea of men being gods and men being able to create the world themselves, and that very idea made it possible for things like artificial intelligence to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And she stops along the way. We meet Ada Lovelace, who is Byron's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And Ada Lovelace is credited with being the first computer programmer.
Yep.
And one thing that's interesting is this character of Victor Stein keeps popping up through the... So every time there's a new technology that happens, Victor Stein shows up and talks to Mary Shelley. And Mary Shelley's sort of like, yeah, you're a character from my book. What are you doing here? And he's like... well, hi, Mary Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
You figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fascinating.
It's wild. I don't know. I loved it.
And did it make you queasy about artificial intelligence and where we're going?
I mean, it probably should have. But I am one of those people who, like, I read, what is it, The Circle by
Dave Eggers.
And I was like, oh, man, I'm here for it.
Jeez.
Like, I watch Black Mirror and I'm like, yeah, but that's cool technology. Like, yeah, it's destroying the world and it's evil, but
But it's cool, though. Like, I am so into technology that it does not. It should scare me.
The characters argue back and forth amongst themselves about it. So yeah. Victor Stein is like, no, this is going to save us. If we do this, we're going to be able to go to other planets. It's not going to matter that humans couldn't exist there.
Nope. Yeah.
Because artificial intelligence could exist there. But then there's this woman, Claire, mm-hmm. who is the corollary, is Mary Shelley's stepsister back in the day, who's very religious and who's like, no, you don't mess with God.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely more on Victor's team of like, yeah, but I don't know, man, it's cool. It's an interesting book that is one of those books where I finished it and I felt smarter for having read it. It is a very intelligent read while also being fun and a little bit spooky. And
there's a lot of sex in it.
There's a ton of sex.
Yeah, there's a lot of sex. So if you're crazy about that stuff, don't get into it. But it wasn't gratuitous.
No.
But I would recommend reading Mary Shelley's Frankenstein first.
Yes. That was the first classic novel that I read. I read it in high school I forget what class it was, that I just fell in love with. I was expecting to hate it because, you know, it's high school. Classic. They're assigning you a classic literature. Like, well. And I think I was one of the only people in the class who actually finished it. And I loved it. I loved it so, so much. It's a phenomenal novel. It's one of those ones where when teenagers come in and they either have to read it for school or like someone has recommended it to them and they're rolling their eyes. And it's one of the ones where I'm like, okay, no, but there's a reason this one is still in print. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason that Mary Shelley is so renowned for starting the sci-fi genre, and like, this is worth it. Like, give it a shot. This one's worth it. It's really good.
And I would recommend, too, I actually have an edition of it here, which is a critical edition of it that was published by Norton. But if you get a critical edition of it, there's going to be all kinds of extra stuff in it. Like, there's, you know, Mary Shelley's mother was Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote, what's it called, The Rights of Women? She died in childbirth, giving birth to Mary Shelley.
Hmm.
And she was a feminist in the 1700s, saying that women are equal to men.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, why she started thinking about writing it, et cetera, et cetera. So and Frankenstein itself is not that long of a book. It's almost
It's actually very accessible as far as classics go.
Yeah, it's like 130 pages or something like that. And don't think that if you've seen the movie, you know
it's
not at all like the movie. You must read the book. It's so different.
Frankenstein is so good. It makes me think of, I have in my stack here, Dracula, which is another classic horror that I read. And I did enjoy, it's less, I feel like, accessible than Frankenstein. It's a little bit...
It's still great,
though. It's fantastic, but I feel like it takes much, much longer to get to the meat of the story. I mean, you're like more than halfway through before Dracula actually bites anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But that moment... Oh, so good.
Really tragic, too. The heroine, well, spoiler alert, dies, you know?
Yeah.
I mean? But my favorite character is, what is his name? The helper.
Renfield.
Who eats the flies and then eats the spider. And then he's like, it's the original lady who swallowed a fly, Renfield. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. It is so creepy. And then when you finally get back to Dracula's castle and all of his, like, sisters and wives and all the crazy lady vampires come out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Really good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one that I definitely would say, like, give that one a shot and stick with it for a while. Because, like I said, there's a lot of buildup before you get to... like, the moment. Like, the first time he kind of, like, enthralls the female main character and gets in there and bites her, I was like, oh my god, it's happening! But it takes a long time to get there. There's a lot of backstory.
God, Dracula. Wouldn't you give anything to be able to write one book like this that would last for 200
years? Right?
Yeah.
Come on! It's unfair.
Well, someone's doing it right now.
Oh, definitely. Kelso, what about you? What are some of your
favorite spooky reads.
All right, so backstory on me personally. So, like Ryan, not a lot of things terrify me as an adult. When I was a kid, there was a lot. I'm a very nervous person to begin with. One of the things that first scared me when I was a kid was a book called Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark by Alvin Schwartz.
Classic.
Yes.
Which is a classic book. My kid is now currently reading it and thusly being scared by all of the photos and drawings in the book. Because everybody remembers the drawings.
Yes.
The drawings what hooked all the kids. And either you were terrified and your parents would never let you pick the book out from the library. Mm-hmm. And it's a very frequently challenged book. Or you had cool parents like me and my mother who were, like, super enthralled but also very scared of all of these illustrations. Mm-hmm. And that book terrified me as a kid. I listened to it, like, on tape, like an actual physical cassette tape we had. And I would listen to it before bed because I'm a glutton for punishment.
Yes!
It is creepy.
And your mother is a glutton for punishment.
I know. Yep. And, like, the one story I remember out of the entire series was the one with the spider that lays the eggs in the thing.
Yes.
And there's the folk tales around it where if you went to, like, the Burlington Coat Factory and grabbed the coat from, like, darkest Peru and you put it on, there were spiders in it. Oh! So that stuff used to scare me. And I enjoyed being scared. I enjoyed this, like, terrifying piece of me. Then when I got into high school, I read a lot of Christopher Pike, who is, like, 80s paperback slasher, you know, you can't make out kids because then the slasher is gonna get you. And then the first book I remember reading when I was like a teenager was Carrie. And so my mother gave me Carrie because I was, you know, an outcast. I wasn't really popular in high school. And Carrie is also not popular in high school.
So she was like, here, Kelso, it's okay. You can just murder everyone with your brain.
Right. It's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine to think these thoughts. Now, so if you don't know Stephen King's Carrie, which I think everybody in New England has heard.
It's the bloody prom. That's the one. Yeah.
The pig's blood. The dirty pillows. Everything like that.
Yep.
But in the first part of the book when she, you know, when she gets her period for the first time in the stall.
So she's dying.
And it just shows you how terrible high school is. And it just really connected with me.
Yep.
And the fact that she, you know, all of these mean kids get their comeuppance at the end with her telekinetic powers and her highly religious abusive mother getting it. And like,
it's so cathartic.
It's such a great it's a cathartic horror book, and I feel like it's Stephen King's best novel, and that's me, and I will fight you on that, Deborah. Like, it's such
it's so good.
It's a fabulous book, and it's fabulous to read when, like, you're the goth kid in high school, and, like, nobody understands you. It's such a great book, so.
But you did go to your prom.
I did go to my prom. Nobody dumped pig's blood on me, thankfully.
That's good.
But, like, I was the one who was wearing all black, and nobody understood why I was wearing all black prom dress. Things like that.
Amazing.
So then it got to a point. We have to talk about H.P. Lovecraft.
Yes!
Because H.P. Lovecraft, I know he's problematic, but we have to talk about him because H.P. Lovecraft is one of the bastions of American horror, and his short stories still hold up. The two of my favorite short stories out of this collection is The Color Out of Space and The Mountains of Madness. Mm-hmm. Growing up, I read The Mountains of Madness. I lived in a very wintry, cold, Arctic place growing up. And The Mountains of Madness is about an Arctic expedition that this person from Miskatonic University takes a bunch of students up there to go investigate what happened to this expedition. They find this, like, ancient alien city high up in the peaks of the mountains of Antarctica. And then a smaller party had gone out before them, and they lost contact. So the remaining party goes to try to find them in the city. And they find their campsite, and all of the people and all of the dog sled team are eviscerated. Like, dissected, eviscerated, just gory and gross. And all of the other rest of the students from the remaining party were like, we got to get out of here because there's obviously something terrifying lurking in this snowy world. And so at the end of the story, the narrator of the book is looking out the airplane and sees something so terrifying, he literally goes insane. Like, he loses it in the airplane. It's a warning to other people to not go back into the city. Mm. And it's like one of the basis of the movie The Thing by John Carpenter. Mm. It was just terrifying. It's terrifying. I can't handle it. And The Color Out of Space is a star falls to Earth in the middle of this valley. And there's a farmer who lives in this plane. And they see this thing fall to Earth, but they don't really go up and take a look at it. And then throughout the year, their crops start forming weird and everything loses color. Hmm. Everything starts turning black and white. And then it starts to crumble into dust. And then the crops all start crumbling to dust. And then the valley is all dead and gone. And the house starts turning into colorless things. The child goes missing. And then the child's bones are found in the middle of the well. Like,
oh my God.
And just things keep happening. And at the end of the book, it is also a warning to the people who are going to flood the valley with a dam for drinkable water for the rest of the Miskatonic place. So I love H.P. Lovecraft. Their short stories are great. I want to talk about this particular book that just came out. It's called The New Annotated H.P. Lovecraft Beyond Arkham. It is edited with a foreword and notes by Leslie S. Killinger. But the reason why I am strongly suggesting this particular book is the introduction is by Victor Laval, who is the man who wrote The Changeling, and he's written a bunch of other scary horror books.
Yeah.
And the reason why I bring this up is because the introduction to this is so fascinating. So Victor Laval is a black man, and H.P. Lovecraft was very famously known as a racist.
Hmm.
And so Victor Laval grew up reading and enjoying and falling in love with H.P. Lovecraft's work. And then it came out when he was older, he realized that H.P. Lovecraft is a very racist man.
Mm-hmm.
So in the introduction, he has to talk about and discuss how do we draw the art from the artist?
Mm-hmm.
And why do these books still stand the test of time? And why should we pull ourselves away from the art to the artist? And he's trying to grapple with this. It's kind of his own version of a horror tale. So mm-hmm. that's why and this just came out. It's a beautiful edition.
It's really
lovely. Should really get it.
I'm looking at it, and the way the light is reflecting off the cover, there are animals and skeletons, and the animals have these yellow eyes, and when the light hits it, the eyes glow a little bit. It's a really beautiful book.
It's all annotated. It is full of all kinds of illustrations.
Full color photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to say, H.P. Lovecraft is one of the most emulated horror writers ever. It's sort of like, you know how people make all kinds of movies and plays that are based on Shakespeare?
Yeah.
There are all current horror writers sometimes will take a Lovecraft plot and make their own version of it. And Victor Laval has done that himself. And very often, what they're doing when they do it is addressing his racism or his other strange idiosyncrasies.
Hmm.
So, he's really worth reading, but you need to know going in that there are going to be moments when you're like, what did you just say?
Right. Huh. Two more. I used to work as a mortuary assistant. So what I used to do is I would help cremate bodies, and I would help transport bodies from their scenes of death, like a hospital or a nursing home or, in other times, a crime scene, to wherever they need to go, the funeral home, the medical examiner's office. So I've seen a lot of death. And most of the time I've been, like, when I watch horror movies like Ryan, I don't really get grossed out or scared necessarily by a lot of things because I've seen a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, things that scare me the most are serial killers and true crime. It just scares me that monsters are real and things are scary. And so what is scarier than the bastion of all true crime,
yeah.
In Cold Blood by Truman Capote,
yep.
Is the scariest book I've ever read as an adult, because it is a true account about the Cutter family back in the 50s. They lived on a farm. They were very well known. And two men, just in the middle of the night, go in there attempting to rob them, is what they said, that they wanted to rob them. And they shoot 4 out of the 5 people, gun, like point blank range with shotguns. Oh. And this is Truman Capote's account of what happened and how it shockwaved the entire tiny community. Things like this never really happened, quote unquote, back then. Truman Capote gets really into investigating the killers. He goes and he talks to them and interviews them, and he talks about their relationship with each other. It's got a 3-tier narrative with the victims, what happens with the murder and the community at large. It is allegedly well-researched, and I say allegedly because there has been light that he's taken artistic liberties with some of the things that he talks about in the book.
And people say that he manipulated the one of the guys. You know, mm-hmm. he spent a lot of time sort of courting him.
Right.
There are some... If this book came out today, he would be taking a lot of criticism.
Right. But it is a classic mm-hmm. true crime. Super scary because it's written like fantasy or it's written like fiction, but it's not. It really happened.
Yeah.
And it's just, and like Harper Lee, he was really good friends with Harper Lee, and they had read about this murder in the New York Times, and then they went down to investigate, and so Harper Lee was helping him write this book, and it's just a fantastic true crime novel. It is the second best-selling true crime novel in history.
Wow. Do you know the story about Bill James, the writer who, he was a baseball writer, but then he's also written some books about serial killers?
I have not.
He grew up in this area, and in his book about murders, he talks about how he realizes that his father, who he's never met, was one of the murderers in Cold Blood.
What a twist!
What? Oh my God.
Isn't that so crazy? Good. So, In Cold Blood, Truman Capote, one of the scariest horror books, quote-unquote, true crime books that I've ever read. I'll recommend that to anybody. So, for the bomb of all of this.
Whoa.
So, I like reading about nonfiction. Spook Science Tackles the Afterlife by Mary Roach is about science-based, fact-based stuff about how science is figuring out if we have a soul or if there's an afterlife. And it is written the way Mary Roach has always written these, very tongue-in-cheek. She's written other books. She wrote it. Her first really big major hit was Stiff.
Yeah.
So she writes a bunch of books. She wrote a book about sex called Boink, which I thought was so funny.
Yeah. She's great. Oh, yeah. I didn't know about Spook.
So Spook is investigations on the possibility of an afterlife. They talk about attempts to define a soul. They take one of the stories in this book is an operating table, and they have people in the operating table for a near-death experience. So they have electronics at the top of the ceiling to see if the leaves the body. Yeah. They weigh slugs post-mortem to see if they have any weight to them, if they've lost weight. The only type of... She goes and investigates the only ectoplasm ever known to exist. And my favorite chapter is court cases that involve ghosts somehow.
Yeah. Oh my
it's
gosh.
Just a fascinating book. And she's so funny when she writes. And, you know, we get a lot of people who come in the store and they're like, I want a book about UFOs, or I want a book about ghosts, but like paranormal investigations.
Yep.
This is usually a book that I press on people who want to read about
awesome.
That type of thing.
You know, if there's another book that I would recommend that's in the same vein, which is Ghost Hunters by Deborah Bloom, BLUM.
Oh yeah.
And the subtitle is William James and the Hunt for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. And William James, people might know, as sort of the founder of the science of psychology. He was the first teacher at Harvard who taught psychology, and he also is famous for a book about religion that he wrote. But he's Henry James's brother.
Oh,
the
no way.
Henry, yep. And and he started a scientific organization where they were trying to prove that there was life after death. Mm-hmm. And basically what they wound up proving was that all these seances, everything was fake. Mm-hmm. But there was one thing he could never disprove, and it happened in New Hampshire.
Of course it did.
So, really worth reading.
And that was the bookcase where...
that was my bookcase, right, with the Exorcist.
That's right. It was Ryan's book. It keeps moving around. No, it was a woman who was able... A woman disappeared, and there was another woman who since childhood had been having dreams, mm-hmm, that she could see things. And she didn't want to tell anybody about it because people thought she was weird, and she finally came forward and said, I think I know where she is, and was able to describe where she was, and turned out she had slipped off a bridge, and they found her exactly where she said they would find her.
Wow. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah, right?
So oh Ghost Hunters, Deborah Bloom.
That's awesome. I'm just looking at... I made a list of some of my favorite spooky reads. And so I just wanted to give a few shout-outs before we start wrapping up. The Need by Helen Phillips, mm-hmm, who Kelso and I met a few months ago. Reading that as a new mom was really creepy, because it is about paranoia and this, you know, idea that, like, your kid is going to be kidnapped, and it's a new mom who is dealing with postpartum depression, and her paranoia turns out was for good reason, and there's a home invasion, and it gets way crazier than, mm-hmm, that, so I won't spoil anything, but that one, like, the first few chapters, I actually had trouble reading. It opens with her, and she thinks someone is in her house, and she is holding her two children, and she's trying to keep the baby from making a sound, and my toddler was across the room asleep, and I was like, oh god, what would I do? Don't worry, all the kids
about
are
all
fine.
Those smothering stories.
Yeah, no, don't worry, the kids are
the
fine.
The kids are okay.
The kids are okay. Everything's fine, but, well, you have to read it.
But, dot, dot, dot.
The kids are fine.
The kids are fine.
The kids are okay.
But that's a really good one. I've been reading House of Leaves by Mark Z. Danieluski, which
on
I know
my list.
Kelso loves as well. Our former coworker Brian kind of beat me over the head with this book, was like, you gotta read this, mm-hmm, you gotta read this, you gotta read this. So I'm slowly making my way through that one. It is a trip to read. There's a lot of, it's story within a story within a story. There are footnotes and annotations, and pages are upside down and backwards, and it's crazy, but it is pretty scary. It is a very, very interesting story. I also really loved You by Carolyn Kepnes, which is the basis for the TV series.
About a creepy bookseller,
by the way. About a creepy bookseller, a serial killer bookseller. but it's really good. The book is wild because it's written from his perspective, and he's unhinged. I love reading an unreliable narrator, and so I really, really loved reading You, because you're in his head, and he just is crazier and crazier and crazier as the book goes, and you're like, he's justifying so much unjustifiable stuff. Yeah, it's really fantastic. A couple of YA ones, Pumpkinheads by Rainbow Rowell is a graphic novel about two teenagers who work at a pumpkin patch.
It's
and
cute.
They're best friends, and it's really sweet. It's, mm-hmm, the last day of the pumpkin patch. They're going off to college. They're not going to be coming back to the pumpkin patch the next year, and they're just kind of, like, really embracing their time there. The one character has a crush on this other girl who works at the pumpkin patch, and so his best friend is like, I'm going to help you, like, get together with her tonight. Like, we're going to do this. And they end up tearing all over the pumpkin patch trying to catch up with this girl, and it's really, really sweet. It's so, so cute. I love Rainbow Rowell. You guys know this. So that one's really fun. The Coldest Girl in Coal Town by Holly Black, there's like a vampire community, and the humans know that the vampires exist, and the vampires are sort of sequestered to their community, but they're, it's like reality television. Like, they're, you can like live stream the vampires, you can like watch them partying and all this stuff, and so there are humans who they try to sneak into the vampire community so that they will become vampires, they'll get bitten. And so it's the story of a girl who is sneaking off to do that, and I think it's her sister is going to go save her. It's like her sister and one of her friends. And yeah, so I have lists upon lists upon lists. I will stop there because otherwise this episode will be 2 hours long.
Right.
Okay, cool. So coming events. Tonight, when this airs, Tuesday, October 29th at 6 p.m., we've got Susie Staubach presenting A Garden Miscellany, an illustrated guide to the elements of the garden. That should be fun.
It's a beautiful book, too. Mm-hmm.
It is really beautiful. Mm. Yeah, we got it in and I was looking through it. And then this Friday, November 1st at 6 p.m., Cynthia Anderson shares Home Now, How 6,000 Refugees Transformed an American Town. Saturday, November 2nd at 2 p.m., we have a YA author, Tammy Truax, presenting her YA novel in verse, For to See the Elephant. So if you liked David Eliot's novels in verse, he has Bull, he has Voices, you might like her novel in verse as well. There are so many things happening in November. What's our book club in November?
Confederates in the Attic.
Confederates in the Attic. So that's the first Monday in November. And then we also have, there's going to be a NaNoWriMo write-in event on the 23rd.
Tell people what NaNoWriMo is.
Yeah, so November is National Novel Writing Month, which I am crazy enough to be participating in for the 7th year in a row. It's essentially, at its core, you, in 30 days, write 50,000 words. So you write a short novel. It is just sort of like a massive community event. It's nationwide. It's worldwide, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a ton of fun. It's super stressful.
It's a good way of getting through writer's block, you know.
Definitely.
Because you can't think.
Yes,
you just have to write.
You write 1,667 words a day to stay on track. And yeah, so we're doing a write-in event on the 23rd. Gibson's is an open write-in space. We have Wi-Fi, we have comfy chairs, we have outlets, we have a cafe.
You have some desks.
We have desks. Come right here. But especially on the 23rd, we're going to be having a big event. Our local author, Aaron Bowman, is going to come chat about writing and publishing. We're going to have pizza. It'll be great. So,
Erin Bowman writes in our cafe.
She does. Mm-hmm. She's one of our in-house writers. So definitely check out our events calendar on the website for all that and more. As a quick reminder, our listeners can receive 3 digital audiobooks for the price of 1 credit from Libro FM by using the code LAYDOWN at checkout. So do take advantage of that. That's a really, really amazing deal that we have worked out with them.
And Christmas is coming.
Christmas is coming. You're going to hear so much more about audiobooks in our next episode. We're doing an audiobook-specific episode. We're kind of teaming up with Libro FM for that. So definitely look forward to that. Okay, you can email us about the podcast at thelaydownpodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gibsonsbookstore.com. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and we'll put those links in the show notes along with all of the books we talked about today. And I might even include my list that I didn't get to. Those will also be in the show notes. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the stacks.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.